Wisconsin has a lot of wetland areas. Unfortunately, we've lost a lot of areas, but we still have many, and we're going to see how those remaining wetlands are doing right now with our guests. Katie Belfus back with us today. She is the Outreach Programs Director of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Katie, welcome back.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
And with us as well, Aaron O'Brien. And Aaron is the Policy Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Aaron, good to see you as well.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And as you listen to these two experts talk, I hope you'll join in with your own conversations. What questions you have about our wetlands, I hope you'll join in. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, you can also post on our Facebook page. Katie, I ask you this every time, but let's do it again. Tell us about the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Give us a little overview, how it got started, and what you do.
Sure. Well, our organization is almost coming up to its 50th anniversary, which is going to be fun to celebrate next year, 2019. And we were founded as the Dane County Wetlands Association a long time ago to a group of folks who said, look, nobody's speaking up for wetlands, and we love them, and we want to speak up for them to make sure that we take care of these important systems on our landscape. And over time, our organization has grown and added staff and expanded so that we now cover the full state of Wisconsin. And we work to promote the protection, restoration, and enjoyment of Wisconsin's wetlands, protecting those that remain on our landscape, restoring wetlands where they have been altered or drained, and helping promote folks getting out and enjoying getting their feet wet and really learning more and spending time in these beautiful places.
It's fun. It's a fun thing to do is to spend time in our wetlands.
Definitely.
Lots of good things going on.
And that enjoyment thing comes into all of our programs, whether we're working with private landowners or local governments or other elected officials. We work with whoever wants to work with us to help care for wetlands. We help people and communities care for wetlands.
And Aaron O'Brien, talk about what you do within the organization.
Well, my title is Policy Director, and over the years, I've been there almost 15 years, that has morphed a bit to mean a number of things. So one mm-hmm. thing we do in our program, we have several staff in the policy program, is track and respond to proposals that are coming through our legislature that have the potential to affect how we protect, restore, and manage wetlands in the state. And sometimes that work is defensive, so responding to ideas that maybe we think will harm wetland resources, but we're also working very hard to promote good policies and good practices that we'd like to see put in place for the management of wetlands in the state. But we also do a lot of work with local governments because they control land use in the state. And so that work involves helping them think about planning and zoning and how local land use decisions affect wetlands and how wetlands affect local communities in terms of things like water quality and flooding and other water resource concerns.
You know, and this year, we had a cool, wet spring and summer for most of the state this year. What was that, good or bad for wetlands?
Well, the thing about wetlands is they thrive on variability. And if we always had a lot of water, wetlands would be less healthy. If we always had little water, wetlands would be less healthy. But the fact that water levels can go up and down from season to season or from year to year actually helps with wetland resilience in the long term because it favors different conditions in different years, which might favor different plants. People talk about doing, when you get low water levels and mud flats, there's certain annual species of plants that will come in and grow, and some of those produce some of the very best waterfowl food in the fall for their migration. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't have those low periods periodically, you wouldn't get that plant growth. But again, if you had only that low period, then a lot of other things would grow in that area, and those annuals that provided those food, they wouldn't be able to grow. So the variability is actually really good from year to year and from season to season. This year, it's meant a lot of great places to raise baby ducks and other waterfowl. So that'll be really good for the season this year.
This year. Paul in Door County has something. Let's just go there. Paul, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, so I'm up on Europe Lake, and I got a question. Europe Lake drains into a wetlands. There's a culvert that drains it. And, you know, up until, like, this year and last year, the lake gets pretty low at the tail end of the summer. And I've noticed because we've had a lot of water this year that suddenly the lake dropped, like, 2 feet in the last week and a half or 2 weeks. And we have a lot of grass growing in there now, and I'm wondering how the wetlands affect that and the water level, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting question, and I wish I could be out on the landscape with you looking at it in person, because that would make answering this question a lot easier. But lake levels do vary, much like wetland levels, based on how much water is falling from the sky or melting mm-hmm. from the snow. And that water, those water levels will change in lakes much as they do in wetlands. Wetlands won't necessarily affect... Water flows downhill, and so that mm-hmm. lake is going to drain into the wetland or empty as its surface makes it do so. You know,
sure.
But the wetland is not blocking the water, or the wetland shouldn't be affecting the lake levels. It might be the other
way
around.
There's actually there's a culvert that goes out,
yeah.
And so the water drains into the wetlands.
Correct.
I mean, there, in the last 2 weeks, it's literally dropped 18 inches. That's not evaporation.
No.
But it might be, have you had much rain in the last 2 weeks there?
It's been pretty wet up here. We probably had the highest water levels ever, but that's why the drop is so drastic.
Right. Well, and unless they've done some change downstream to the size of the culvert or to whatever is on the other side of the wetland draining that wetland or wherever that water is going from the wetland, there could have been some work further downstream that might have affected the water flow through there. But otherwise, it might, unless that culvert is new or has been expanded, I don't know why the wetland would have anything to do with the water level of the lake, separate from, you know, nature, broadly speaking, whether the water levels are going down because we didn't get as much rain the last week or so.
The last couple of weeks have been pretty low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's also true that, you know, depending upon what that culvert looks like and how it's managed and whether it's sized properly and put in at the right depth, et cetera, that the culvert itself could be affecting what's happening in the lake and or what the wetland is receiving. So, you know, it's not a natural situation, so to speak. When you have a lake connected by a culvert, there was probably some more natural channel connecting those two water bodies originally, and there would have been a more dynamic and fluid interaction between those water bodies. So, if you're concerned that there's a problem that somehow the culvert is affecting the health of your lake, that would be something to invite your town or your county to come out and take a look at.
Yeah, there could be other issues mm-hmm. That come into play here as well, because mm-hmm. there have been many lakes that have actually dropped considerably mm-hmm. based on other practices that are going on in the state. You know, I was thinking about, I was reading an article the other day, and, you know, we had the huge hurricane and Harvey and so forth and hitting Houston, and I was reading about the zoning or the lack of zoning that exists in the Houston area, and as one, obviously you get 50 inches of rain, you're going to, there's nothing that's going to not create some problems, but there may have been more problems than were really necessary because of a lack of zoning.
And our message following Harvey, you know, it was devastating and awful, and I have family in the area, so, you know, yeah. personally invested there as well. But the message is let's not be in a position where we have to ask ourselves, did we do enough to prepare for something like this? Let's stop and say, what's our community doing now here that will make sure that we have the natural infrastructure and solid infrastructure that will help us manage big rain events. That was an extraordinary rain event. As you said, there's no wetland on the planet that could have absorbed. I mean, there's no situation where there would not have been flooding there. That's just a lot of water. But let's make sure our communities here are stopping to think about what is our natural infrastructure and how can we bring that to bear to protect our community and to give us better water conditions.
How is... And I'm not saying that the hurricane was necessarily caused by climate change, because we have hurricanes every year, but I'm wondering about climate change and how it affects wetlands now and what the future might look like in terms of climate change.
Well, it's interesting you asked that question, because part of my job as outreach programs director is organizing our annual science conference, and we're going to have a theme this year on wetland resilience and bring in some folks to talk about that very question, Larry. So good timing. We can talk about that more later, too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a couple of things there. Wetlands can offer a lot of important services that will help us manage the changes that are predicted to come with a changing climate, whether it's increased strength of storm events or frequency or the amount of rain. But wetlands are also very vulnerable to those things as well. And so there's ways that we can bring wetlands to bear to help our communities. And there's ways that we as managers, land managers, need to think through how we're going to help our own wetlands adapt to the changing conditions that might be coming their way. And are there ways that we can change our management here to help that be more healthy in the long run?
Yeah, so that's something you guys are focusing on. How do you focus on something like that? What's process do you go through?
I'm really looking forward to our conference, because I don't know some of the answers to those questions, but I want to talk with the people who are doing that work, because there are a lot of people who are focusing on what are the changes going to be to the weather patterns, what are the changes going to be on the landscape, how are those going to affect wetlands, and it's going to be different for different kinds of wetlands. The way that a marsh responds versus a upper watershed ephemeral pond, those are going to be different because they're different systems. And so there are people who are doing a lot of great work trying to evaluate that and make plans and help managers make plans to take care of those communities moving into a changed climate.
And maybe you can talk for a minute about the conference itself and just...
Yeah, our conference happens in February every year. This year it'll be held in Oconomowoc, February 20th to 22nd. And we have a wetland resilience theme, and we're putting together the program right now. And if you're somebody doing science or management on the landscape in Wisconsin related to wetlands, we'd love to hear from you. And we have our call for presentations out right now if you'd like to submit an abstract. And it's open to the public, too.
And your site as well, talk a little bit about your online site.
Sure. We have a great webpage, new last fall, and a lot of great information in there about what wetlands are, why they matter, how folks can get involved, some very specific information if you are a wetland landowner yourself and want some guidance and assistance on what you can do to care for your wetland, as well as information for local communities who might be interested in getting involved in planning and zoning activities like Aaron mentioned earlier. So a lot of great information. Go check it out, wisconsinwetlands.org.
Katie Belfus is the Outreach Programs Director of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, and Aaron O'Brien is a Policy Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet, and then we'll be back to talk with them some more. So you stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We are taking a look at our Wisconsin wetlands today with our two guests, Katie Belfus, back with us. She's the Outreach Programs Director of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And in the studio with us, Aaron O'Brien, who is the Policy Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. So how important are wetlands to you? You can join in our conversation. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org and post on our Facebook page. We have a link on our page to the new Ideas Network page. I hope you'll check that out. It's a great place to learn about all of the Ideas Network shows, so I hope you'll do that as well. And again, 800-642-1234, the number to call. Let's go to Judy in Eau Claire, who has a comment or question. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I was wondering, with Foxconn coming to Wisconsin, how that might affect our wetlands, being that some of the regulations have been waived.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go to Aaron O'Brien for that. Aaron?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Judy. So the short answer is we don't entirely know, because the negotiations between the state and the business have not been open to the public, so we don't exactly know where the facility and campus will be located. What we do know is a lot about the landscape of Racine and Kenosha counties, where they have been looking, and it's clear from the legislation that's passed, which, for those listeners that don't know, exempted any manufacturing facility within a designated zone from wetland permit requirements. So it's clear that they are likely to site on a parcel that has wetlands, but the ones that have been in the news that we've looked at are also largely parcels that are in agricultural use. So the wetlands that remain are farmed, and many of the wetlands that used to be there were drained, you know, more than 100 years ago or so. So, you know, the upside is we're hopeful that it won't result in impacts to very high quality or very large acres of wetlands, but we don't necessarily know. The bigger concern, I'd say, was that we felt the policy itself wasn't necessary, that there would be a better approach to enabling this development to go in while also upholding the protections and review policies that we have on hand now to make sure those impacts are not harmful.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it, Judy. Bruce in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. Hi, Aaron and Katie, the Bruce Dedman here.
Hey, Bruce.
How you been?
Good.
I just wanted to compliment WWA and both of these fine folks. I'm a senior volunteer with Ducks Unlimited and also with a group called the Clean Bay Backers, and we're just a few of the many organizations that are pulling, together in a real constructive way on a lot of wetlands restoration and conservation issues, and WWA is a very important part of that. So I just wanted to pass along my kudos.
That's so nice of you. Thank you, Bruce. And I'll just say we love working with you. And for those of you that haven't been lucky enough to meet Bruce, he is a force to be reckoned with and a real staunch wetland advocate and ally. So thanks to you and the work that Ducks Unlimited does in Wisconsin on behalf of wetlands.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Thanks, Bruce. Appreciate the call. I want to go back. You know, we talked just before the news break about Houston and suffering unprecedented flooding. We've seen our share of that in Wisconsin as well. And we've had some, obviously we've had some bad, but we've had some, it could have been a lot worse kind of situation as well.
Well, I think anytime you have a crisis like this where people's lives are put at risk and property damage is a big situation, it helps everybody step back and say, how can we prevent this and what can we do better, or how can we make sure that this doesn't happen to us? We've had a lot of rain. Last year, there was huge flooding up north in the Superior and Ashland area, in those areas, tons of infrastructure damage up there from huge amounts of water coming through. We've seen a lot of impacts from big rain events in the Driftless area and in southeast Wisconsin this year. And so it's a good opportunity to say how can we do better moving forward to be able to prevent this kind of damage and harm to our communities. So that's where we're turning our focus, is what's the role of wetlands in those in those areas to help with managing that kind of water. And is there a connection? Because we always talk about water, wetlands being the great sponges of the landscape that grab on and hold on to water and then release it over time. And we know that to be true, and we're also continuing to try to find examples where we can tell that story on the landscape, actual places where, for example, in Watershed A, they still have a healthy upper watershed area with lots of wetlands, with lots of healthy forests. How does that compare to what's happening in Watershed B, where they might have converted and lost some of their upper watershed wetlands? Was there a difference in the way that same storm affected those two separate watersheds? So being able to tell the story right here in Wisconsin on our landscape so that we can then work with communities, say, well, how can we help you? How can wetlands be part of the solution for you?
Yeah.
The other thing I'd like to add to that is just that something that we're working really hard to do in both our education and our policy programs is to help communities think about what we like to call the legacy of wetland loss. So where were wetlands? Where did they used to be in our communities before we came through and developed or drained? And what are the consequences of those changes? I mean, we have drained or developed millions of acres of wetlands in the state, and we can't make those changes without there also being some consequences of those changes. And we see the legacy of those changes in the water resource management problems we face all over the state, whether it's flooding or water quality or stream erosion or rivers being disconnected from their floodplains. And our message is, first, we need to understand, how and where wetlands have contributed to those problems, and then what can we do about it in a modern context, leveraging wetland restoration to help not solve, but help address some of those problems.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's go back to the phones. Again, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your comments. Eric in Beloit, it's your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question about wetlands themselves. What constitutes a wetland? Do they have to have their own water source? Do they have to be attached to a river or something? Can they be a place where water just naturally drains because of the terrain? So that's my question.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Great question, Eric. And So wetlands form where there's the right kind of soil, and that soil actually forms in response to water, because there's certain kinds of soils that develop in situations where you have a lot of water in the soil over time. So there's is there the right soil? Is there the right hydrology? Is there water at or near the surface? These are regulatory definitions I'm giving here, too.
So, yeah.
Is there water at or near the surface of the soil for all or part of the year? And are there wetland plants growing there, plants that have special adaptations that enable them to have wet feet for a period of time when not drowned? So those are the three things that we say we look for on the landscape. But to get better at Eric's question, wetlands form where we have where the landscape has water that it needs to manage. So whether it is in a low area or where there's a coming together of water, there's a variety of different kinds of wetlands and where they form on the landscape based on what the water needs are there. For example, floodplains are a type of, we have lots of different types of wetlands in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It's not just marshes. People think of Horicon Marsh, great place. That's our ideal picture of what we think of as a wetland, but there's lots of wetlands that have tons of trees. There's lots of wetlands that have a layer of grasses and sedges that's so thick you can't even see that there's water in there. There's not open water. And there's lots of different kinds of wetlands on the landscape, and each of them forms in their own way based on what the conditions are there vis-a-vis the soil, the water, and the landscape around them.
Yeah.
Do you have anything you wanted to add to that, Erin?
I would just add, Eric, that different kinds of wetlands get their water from different places. So much of the water that appears in many of our wetlands is based on precipitation, so rain and snow melt. But we also have, and then those appear in a lot of different places, including what we would call depressional or isolated wetlands, where there really is just a low, not just, there is a low spot on the landscape that's receiving and storing that water, and then that water is infiltrating into our groundwater and popping out someplace else. But we also have wetlands that are almost exclusively groundwater fed, where we have a high water table and it's water coming up into the soil that's creating those wet conditions. And then, as Katie said, you know, floodplain wetlands, where it's basically the land providing a place for the river to roam.
Yeah, there we go. Elliot in Linden Station, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. My question regards construction, because I'm in the construction industry and I hear a lot about farms' impact on wetlands. But I'm curious, in construction, we're required to install a lot of silt fences, turbidity barriers, silt socks, anything to prevent erosion and try to keep the water quality where we want it.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of curious as to the effectiveness of these things, because in reality, they never really seem to be that effective.
Well, they're hard to put up once and just leave there, right? Because things change, a big plug of water come down and things get knocked over or they get clogged up by debris. Those are important practices for preventing the immediate and direct impacts of a construction activity. But we sort of try to take a step back and say, not that we're anti-construction by any stretch of the imagination, but let's look at sort of the bigger impacts. It's not just that temporary during construction impact. It's how is that development, whether it's a parking lot or a building, how is that affecting the wetland in the long term? And that's a really important part of the question. There is a need to protect direct impacts, but there's also the broader question of longer term collective impacts of development and construction.
Right.
But I would say, yes, keep up those silt fences. It's better than nothing, and keep them clean.
So a lot of thought goes into that, before the silt fences even go up, should we even be building?
Oh, we just lost you, Elliot. I'm sorry. You disappeared from our from our hearing.
I do want to say kudos to Elliot for thinking about those questions and being aware, because that there are a lot of great folks in the development industry and construction industry that do care. And people sometimes try to say, you know, development or wetlands, and we think there's an and there instead.
All right. Thanks again. Steve in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question about, developing land, too. Like, if they take 80 acres and say there's a stream or a creek running through it, can they, eliminate that if they want to? Or
yeah.
So there are regulations that affect how development can happen in both wetlands and other waterways. And so it's not encouraged or often approved to eliminate a stream, for example, but we do have a regulatory program that does allow development in wetlands in some cases, but there is a burden on the project sponsor to try to design their project in a way that is sensitive to the resources on the parcel. So that involves maybe both picking development parcels that don't have sensitive resources if possible, and when that's not possible, trying to design the project in a way that avoids and minimizes the impacts to those resources and allows the development and the resources to coexist peacefully.
Well, and that stream, that water is going to come through somewhere. So if you're going to, you can't really get rid of the stream because the water's still going to come through. You got to figure that out. Yeah. It's not necessarily the best place to put something.
And that actually relates also back to Elliot's question a moment ago, where, you know, what I was thinking about as you all were talking was that it's not just about sediment management and soil, it's about water management. Mm-hmm. And so when constructing, you know, before, during, and after, we have to think about what was the water like on the land to begin with? What does it want to do? How has it changed? And how do we make sure that it's still functioning in a healthy way?
Mm-hmm. Mm, interesting. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate the call. Now, Brian in Marquette County, on to you now. Hi, Brian.
Hello there. Yeah, I have probably an opposite of the last caller. Half of our family farm has been turned in to the wetland restoration program, but none of the land scrapes or anything have been done yet. I was wondering what the progress was of that program. How far down the list is it going to be before they start work on some of the projects?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your interest in restoring your family's land to wetlands. That's wonderful. And the Wetland Reserve Program is run through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and we work in partnership with that agency to help them do the best job they can to implement that program on the landscape. I don't know the particulars of where you are in their schedule, and I would encourage you to reach out to your local district conservationist to get an update on that. But we do collaborate with NRCS to hold workshops for landowners whose property is enrolled in this program to help educate folks on what they can do as a landowner and what the best, most effective techniques are for managing your property once the restoration occurs. But do check in with NRCS to find out where you are on that list, because unfortunately, I don't have that info.
Yeah. All right. There we go. Thank you, Brian. Tim in East Troy, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. It seems to me, especially with what happened in Houston and New Orleans recently, things like that, you kind of touched on this earlier, wetlands need to be used more in urbanized areas. And I understand that, or what I've read is that, you know, you can pave over those and trade them off for places out in the country. It's fine that we're doing this stuff, as your previous caller, up in rural areas, but it seems like we could prevent some of these flooding problems in urban areas if we were smarter with our wetland use. I'm all in favor of development, but it seems like, you know, we're creating our own problems here sometimes.
Yeah,
that's exactly right, Tim. And the thing that we like to encourage people to think about when you're concerned about water management problems in general, and particularly flooding because of the public safety considerations, is that we need to think about things on a watershed scale. So whatever's happening in your city, cities tend to be built along rivers or near ports, you know, where there's access to commerce from way back when we first settled. And whatever's happening in your city is downstream of someplace else. And everything that's happened up the line or upstream to the wetlands and the creeks and the streams and the rivers is affecting what's happening in your community, because all of the storage that we once had upstream is sending now more water downstream more quickly. It's also true, you're correct, that we have changed the wetland landscape, you know, down near our urban areas as well. In fact, that's some of the places where the most wetland fill has occurred. So, but it is important to think about when you have problems like these, what are they stemming from and where are the opportunities on the landscape to address them? Sometimes there are things we can do right there in our cities and in our communities. Sometimes there's not as much land available for restoration, or it might not be the most effective restoration as going, you know, further upstream and trying to hold more water on the landscape where it starts.
With that in mind, I was thinking about Tracy Ames' article, mm-hmm. where she talked about the Bibbins Swamp, and I was just absolutely amazed at the value of that swamp in terms of stemming some of the really critical problems that could have occurred.
Sure. Yeah. So Bibbin Swamp, for listeners who might not know, is up north Ashland County, I believe, in the White River watershed. And Tracy Hames, who was our executive director, he was up visiting that community right after some of the big rains that we had in 2016, and said that that swamp soaked up enough run-up to raise its water level by 6 feet, and that's a 14,000-acre wetland. And so that is a lot of water that wetland was able to hold on to. It doesn't eliminate damage downstream, but was super effective at holding on to some of that water. But it's tremendous to think about. But I want to say it's not just the big wetlands that are important.
No.
It's the cumulative impact of a lot of small wetlands in an area, too, that can make a difference. And so there's often talk about, oh, we don't need to pay attention to these tiny puddles because they're small and insignificant. But if you have a whole lot of tiny puddles, that's a lot of water storage. And so the size of a wetland does not portend its impact and the benefits that it could have.
You can even something like these rain gardens that are being built in, for example, in Madison's one place, has had some impact on, even though it's not really a wetland piece.
Well, but it helps with water management in an area where you don't have a lot of other options, and one person doing it doesn't make a huge difference, but if lots of one people did it, it would make a big difference. So,
Bob in Stevens Point, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, I'd like your guest to discuss Central Sand surface water issues, in particular the high-capacity wells.
Yeah, and since we're running out of time, I want to get to Aaron. She's got a couple minutes to at least talk about that. Aaron O'Brien?
Sure, I'll try to be quick here. So, we do know that there are water quantity issues in the Central Sands region, and that pumping has contributed to those issues. We tend to hear about them more in about impacts to lakes and rivers than we do about wetlands, but the reality is if lakes and rivers are getting drawn down as a result of over allocation of water, then our wetlands are also being affected, because essentially the groundwater levels are dropping and all of those systems, the wetlands, the lakes, and the rivers, are groundwater fed. The other thing to keep in mind, though, in the Central Sands area is that we've also seen a lot of wetland drainage. So one of the things that we're doing is we're working with the Village of Plover and some folks in the Little Plover River watershed to be collaborating on a project where we're experimenting with a combination of practices: wetland restoration, on-farm conservation practices, water quantity management by the municipalities and by agricultural operators, to see if we can't come up with some models where the combination of practices can start to bring those groundwater levels back up and improve the health of the associated waterways, in this case the Little Plover River.
So that's one
example.
One example. Yeah. Other examples?
That's the one we're focused on right now. It's a pilot project. So we're hopeful that what we learn there will be exportable to others in the region.
And there's some great work that we're able to draw on to help support that project done by Ken Bradbury at the Wisconsin Geologic and Natural History Survey. And actually, Ken was on with you and me last year because he spoke at our conference. But the modeling work he was able to do on groundwater in that area has been so foundational to then being able to explore some options.
So that's a hopeful note?
Yeah,
absolutely.
you hope, anyway.
Well, we always try to bring science to bear to underlie all of our work, and improving science improves our ability to do the right thing on the landscape.
And how can people get involved in the Wisconsin Wetlands Association?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization. We're membership-driven, membership-based, and so we would love to have any of your listeners who love wetlands to come learn more at wisconsinwetlands.org and become a member if you are so moved. We also have an email distribution list and a Facebook page and other ways that we can communicate with you and share with you what we're doing and what's going on in the state here. Thanks so much.
Yeah, well, thank you both so much for being with us today. I expect you're going to be back.
We will.
Okay. Thanks,
we'll do
Larry.
This all over again. Katie Balfus is the Outreach Programs Director of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Aaron O'Brien is the Policy Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Certainly we'll have them back, and we will do it again with them for sure. Just taking a look ahead, tomorrow at this time, we'll check in with one of our home improvement experts, and we're going to zero in a little bit with him and another guest about solar for your home, and we'll be taking your solar questions. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, Thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store.